This past week, I posted a highly controversial picture on social media. Here's that picture.
And you might think that it's Trump that's the controversial part, but he's not. This was not a political endorsement one way or the other. This was an endorsement of pineapple on pizza. And boy, if you think our president is controversial, he's got nothing on pineapple pizza. My favorite comment on that post was from Evan Meyer, the guy I'm named after. He commented graciously, "Change your first name." So that's cool. Now I know what I know. I know that pineapple on pizza tastes good, at least to me. Can't explain why. I know it's weird, but it tastes good. Doesn't make rational sense, but I know what I know. I know what I know even if I can't explain it. Not just pineapple on pizza. I love hot food. It makes me cry and I love it and I can't tell you why. I know that Steve Carell is funny and Adam Sandler is not. Right now I know they're both really popular. A lot of people love them. But I have my own opinions. I know what I know. I know that one of them makes me laugh and the other one is Adam Sandler. But sometimes life throws a curveball. Sometimes life hits you with something that causes you to question those things that you always knew you knew, but maybe didn't know why. It can cause you to question. Have you experienced that before? Have you experienced maybe somebody saying something to you and their words get in your head and they just nag at you? You can't get those words out of your head. Maybe you notice something for the first time and then you can't unsee it. It's just stuck there. Or maybe somebody challenges you with a perspective that's different from your own and you're forced to grapple with that and wonder maybe you've thought about things wrongly. I think all of us have been there at some point or another before. Now, this sounds like a bad thing and it can be, but not always. If you've been stuck in a bad situation, sometimes getting rattled is the best thing that can happen to you. Sometimes questioning your presuppositions can be extremely healthy. People in abusive relationships, they often don't realize how much danger they're in. And so sometimes having a gentle and compassionate conversation can wake them up and get them out of that dangerous situation. I've known multiple people before who have had what doctors call mild heart attacks, which that alone, what is a mild heart attack? But they've said, multiple people have told me this, that heart attack was the best thing that ever happened to me because it didn't cause lasting, long-term, serious issues for me, but it woke me up to my unhealthy habits. They lost weight, they changed their habits, and now they're healthier because of it. What about Dave Ramsey? That dude loves busting things up, doesn't he? Man, nothing hurts more than sitting down and realizing how much your bad financial decisions have held you captive, and it hurts. But sometimes that knowledge and that painful conversation will start you on a path to changing your financial future. So sometimes questioning our presuppositions can be the best thing for us. But all those examples start in a bad place and go somewhere good, and we all know that's not always how that goes. Sometimes you start in a healthy place. Sometimes you're in a happy marriage, a stable job, healthy eating habits, a strong relationship with God, a balanced budget, and those curveball scenarios can put you off the right track and move you in a direction that's very wrong. So what do we do when that happens? We can't prevent the curveballs, so how do we respond? What do you do when life makes you feel like you no longer know what you know? Well, today we're going to look at a short passage written by the Apostle Peter that addresses that question. This passage is part of some letters written to the churches in Rome. We very creatively call it 1 Peter because it's his first letter. So when Peter sits down to write the book of 1 me, he's in about 60 AD. And if you know anything about history at the time, Nero was the Caesar in Rome. And even if you're not a history buff, you might recognize his name because Nero was maybe one of the worst Christian persecutors in history. He was burning Christians alive. He was crucifying them. In fact, the Apostle Peter would actually die by crucifixion at the hands of Nero. And this is 60 AD. If you know your history, Jesus had only died and resurrected about 30 years ago. Christianity and the church are quite young. And the Christians know that at any point, they could be the next victim on Nero's list. And this would certainly be more than enough to rattle most people, even the strongest of Christians, and they need to figure out what they're going to do about it. So Peter writes this letter and he sends them some advice for how to treat the problem. And he offers a two-part prescription. What and why? That's Peter's two-part prescription. I call it a prescription because it reminds me of some medical advice that I was given. Obviously, I am not a pharmacist. I am not a doctor. Do not follow my advice. This is my little blurb. Don't sue me. This is just what I was told. The doctor told me I came in for migraines. I suffer from migraines. And they said, one day the Tylenol and ibuprofen that you take that's helped to manage somewhat is just not going to work anymore. You'll build up a tolerance to weaker meds. But I'm hesitant to put you on something too strong. Why don't you instead try combining the two? Don't stagger, take them both at the same time. Because when you do, something happens. They chemically react with one another, and they produce a different painkiller, completely different chemical makeup that's stronger than the sum of the parts. In other words, 1 + 1 = 3. This was the advice I was given. And Peter offers similar advice. He says, what and why together are greater than the sum of their parts. He tells them what Christians need to know and do, but he also says they need to know why they know and do those things. And he's going to begin with the what. He reminds them of what they know and what they should do. Here's what it says. Praise be to the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. In his great mercy, he has given us new birth into a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead and into an inheritance that can never perish, spoil, or fade. This inheritance is kept in heaven for you who through faith are shielded by God's power until the coming of the salvation that is ready to be revealed in the last time. All three services, I've almost skipped that second part of the verse because it's such a run-on sentence, I forget that there's more. Okay, so that's his advice. Let me break it down in case the run-on sentence lost you. He says, here's what you believe, and he gives them reminders. He says, Jesus is the Son of God. Remember that. Remember that Jesus raised from the dead, and you too will raise from the dead. Have hope. Then he says, your faith protects you. You're shielded by God's power. These are what Christians should know. And then Peter goes on in chapter 3 to tell them what Christians should do with that knowledge. Here's his advice. He says, finally, all of you, be like-minded, be sympathetic, love one another, be compassionate and humble. Do not repay evil with evil or insult with insult. On the contrary, repay evil with blessing, because to this you were called, so that you may inherit a blessing. So together, these beliefs and actions comprise the what of Christianity, what Christians should know and what they should do. And these things are extremely important, but they're only part of the prescription. It's not enough to know what you believe, you need to know why you believe it. It's not enough to do right, you need to know why you are doing it. When I was a younger man, when I was dating, I knew what I liked in ladies. I knew if a girl was pretty, I knew if she was funny, she's just fun to be around, that's the what. And when you're dating, that's kind of all you have to go on, at least when you get started, is the what. You don't know the person yet. That's the whole point of dating. You date them to find out if you're permanently compatible, long term. Well, now, I've been married to my wife for about 13 years, and all the what still applies. But now there's a why. We've been forged by much stronger fires at this point. We've raised children together. We've lived paycheck to paycheck. We've lived in seasons that have been more financially comfortable. She's cheered with me at my successes. She's cried with me in failure. I know exactly why I love my wife and why we won't become a divorce statistic. Now, it may sound cocky for me to say that right now, but here's the truth. I have learned that why is what keeps people together. And we figured that part out. I know that many of you have been married 2 or 3 times longer than I have. Many have been married 2 or 3 times more than I have. But with 13 years, I feel sufficiently authoritative to say this. Every single successful relationship is rooted in both what and why. What and why. That's the magic. That's what holds it together. What you like about your partner, it's not going to last forever. Beauty fades. Jokes get stale. Ask my wife. Life gets busy, and when life tests you, that what isn't going to hold you together like the why. Newton's first law of physics is the core principle of physics, or so I'm told. I don't science, but it's what they tell me. Here's that principle. An object in motion will stay in motion unless an external force is applied. Likewise, an object at rest will stay at rest unless an external force is applied. This is physics, but it's also a core principle of psychology. Psychologically, you'd say it this way. You will always do what you have always done unless an external force is applied, much like those minor heart attacks. You're just going to keep doing what you've always done. So long as nothing challenging ever comes up in your marriage, You're going to be fine. The what will suffice. As long as your wife never gets a single wrinkle, as long as you never meet a man who's slightly more attractive than your husband, you're going to be fine. The beauty's going to carry you through. As long as Adam Sandler's wife never meets Steve Carell, she's going to keep thinking he's funny and they'll be fine. But that's not how life works. Life throws curveballs. Life hits us with things we're not expecting and it tries to break us down. And that marriage that was moving forward without a why, when it gets hit by an external force, it's going to hit the brakes. But not when you have a strong why. See, I started dating my wife because of the what. She was cute. She was fun. But I married my wife because we're moving in the same spiritual direction. Because our values aligned. Because we both wanted to raise children. Because we were both committed to our community, to our church. We're both committed to each other as both spouses and friends. And man, we have stories to tell. Now, marriage isn't the only example of this. What about your job? Maybe you've got a factory job because you think it's super fun to pull levers and push buttons. I talked at FCA this past week at Franklin High School, and I said, maybe you work at Dairy Queen because you think it's so fun to pull the ice cream lever and make the little whoop-de-doop on top of the cone. But that wears out. If that's the only reason you're working your job, you're gonna quit the first time your boss chews you out. That's just how it goes. But if you know the why of your job, if you know that your job is providing groceries for your family, if you believe in the mission of your company and you wanna carry that forward, if that position is a stepping stone to a promotion, you're gonna keep pulling that lever and you're gonna smile while you do it. Of course your job needs a what. It's not a job without a what, but it also needs a why or you're gonna quit working. Your house needs a why or the chores never get done. Your kids need a why or they live in your basement till they're 42. And Peter doesn't want that for the Christians. So here's what he says. He gives them more advice. He calls this out in chapter 3. He says, even if you should suffer for what is right, you are blessed. Do not fear their threats. Do not be afraid, but in your hearts, revere Christ as Lord. And then here's the why. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. We have a job as Christians. We have a big job, a great commission, if you will. Here's that commission. Go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I've commanded you. You probably know that verse well because it is our job. It's our prime objective to bring other people along with us on the journey, to make heaven as big as possible. And we need to be able to explain the why to the people we meet because what is rarely enough to change somebody's mind. The what isn't always very motivating. Think about it. If you want to invite somebody to go do something with you, when you invite them, you're going to make it sound as fun as possible, right? If you're bringing your kid to go to a doctor's appointment, you ask them questions like, what flavor of sucker are you going to get? What kind of sticker are you going to get? You don't say, hey, buddy, you ready to get your blood drawn? Yeah. And church is the same way. You say, you invite people to church with a what? It just doesn't sound very attractive. Now, hey, Jim, you want to wake up at 6:45 on Sunday and come to church with me? I hear it's going to be 12 degrees and snowing. You say, hey, you should really come to my church. My church is fun. We listen to 30-minute lectures. We give away a tenth of our income. Last week, I changed a diaper. It's a blast. No. Now, at Victory, we understand that the what of Christianity can be a roadblock for non-Christians if it's not of good quality. So we work real hard to have good music, to have good preaching, to create a good culture and environment of good people. But I don't love this church because of the what. To be honest, that stuff just doesn't really track with me. I don't give my money because I'm excited about buying light bulbs and communion cups. It doesn't get me out of bed in the morning. I give to Victory. I give my money. I give my time to Victory because I have seen our church help people break addictions. I've seen our church help people decide against suicide. I've seen churches like Victory uniting families. Victory supports adoptions and discourages abortions. Victory trains, Victory equips, we answer questions, we baptize people. I love Victory because of our why. And it's the same with my personal faith. There are what's about Christianity that I like, but the why is what's important to me. And people will ask you, make no mistake, people will ask you. They're gonna notice your what, and they're gonna notice that it's weird. Your what doesn't look like theirs. They're gonna wonder what's going on when you wake up and drive out early on a cold January morning to come to church. They're gonna wonder what's going on when you start giving your money away. They're gonna wonder what's going on when you start attending a small group despite having an insanely busy weekly schedule. And when they notice those things, they won't ask, what are you doing? They'll ask, why? Why are you doing that? And you need to be prepared to answer that question. Because the answer to that question can change someone's eternity. Now, Peter, he doesn't stop there. He begins with that advice, but there's more to it. You see, the what had two parts. There was the what you know and the what you do. And similarly with the why, there are two parts. There's the why that you tell other people when you want to bring them into the fold, but then there's also the why that reminds you, that fuels you, that holds you up when things get dark. Peter says, for it is better if it is God's will to suffer for doing good than for doing evil. For Christ also suffered once for sins, the righteous for the unrighteous, to bring you to God. Peter says other people, they need to know your why if you want them to believe. But he also talks about this suffering and gives us this reminder because he knows that one day you may suffer for what you believe. And when that happens, you will be the person asking why. And you need to know the answer. One day you may be teetering on the brink of a drastic decision. You may be ready to end a relationship. You may be ready to end your career. You may end your faith. You might be considering ending your life. And when that happens, you won't ask, what's making me feel this way? You will know that answer. You're gonna ask, why? Why am I following a God that just doesn't seem to answer? Why am I following a God that I don't fully understand and can't fully explain? Why am I following a God that isn't taking away the pain? And when you ask those questions, you have to be able to answer. So here's the thing, psychologically, it is really easy to lie to yourself when you want it to be true. I'm great at convincing myself that cheesecake is a healthy breakfast option. But when I'm trying to convince myself of something that's not true, it's almost impossible. You have to have a satisfactory answer or you're gonna have a very hard time overcoming Newton's law. Your body at rest is going to want to continue resting rather than putting in the spiritual work, the relational work, that your faith requires. Your body in motion is gonna wanna keep moving toward those things that are bad for you rather than stopping. And when your family, and when your career, and when your faith, maybe your very life is on the line, you have to know why it matters. Mia experienced this truth herself firsthand when she got hit with a curveball, and she was gracious enough to share her story with us. So if you would, turn your attention to the screen.
Hi, my name is Mia Delph, and I'm 20 years old, and I have been attending Victory, well, for 20 years. And in 2019, I had a doctor's appointment where I was diagnosed with severe depression and anxiety. On that day, she told me pretty much that I would be starting very high dosages of three different medications, and that I would have to go to weekly therapy appointments, and I wanted to refuse because I didn't think I needed the help. I thought I was just being dramatic, and you know, people hear your story, and if they find out you're going to therapy, especially in high school, you'll be known as like a suicidal girl or crazy, and I just didn't want that talk to be going around about me. So for as long as I really could, I hid the truth from everyone I knew. Especially family. A lot of people didn't even know that I was struggling on the inside. But unfortunately, I had a very quick decline. The suicidal thoughts started taking over. It was every day I'd wake up and I'd go to sleep thinking the same thing. Just do it, get it over with. There's no point to be here. No one would really know or miss you. It was a day-to-day thing. I would wake up, I'd go to school, I'd come home, I'd sleep as long as I could because it felt like the peace of dying, but without, you know, having the complications of your family and all of that stuff, so I slept as much as I could. I often didn't eat either, and at this time, what didn't really help was I was in a very toxic relationship. He would constantly yell at me and belittle me, telling me things about me that I was worthless, and to the point where he would corner me in school hallways and scream at me and tell me that I was stupid and a bunch of hurtful things, and I believed him. I mean, he made me think he was all I had, and if I thought the only person I had thought I was nothing, then it must be true. So I started having pains in my chest where it was like my heart physically hurt in a way that didn't ever go away, and I didn't know what to do. So I decided that I would start hurting myself. It felt like it was an ease on my mental health to the point where I became addicted to it, and I truly couldn't go a day without it or without thinking about it. It was calming to me knowing that I was feeling physically hurt instead of just emotionally. Also at this time, I prayed a lot to God. You know, the questions of, why is this happening to me? What's the point? Is there a reason? Like, if you're real, why aren't you fixing this for me? And I didn't get better. And so in November of 2021, I decided I was gonna commit suicide. And I wrote a few suicide notes explaining why I did it and that I loved everyone, but I just couldn't do the pain anymore. And I was going to overdose on medicine. I had it all planned out. And there was one night I was sitting there with them all in front of me and I couldn't do it. Something was just holding me back from it. And that made me very angry because I was in so much pain to the point I didn't want to wake up. I didn't want to feel anything. I didn't want to do anything. And about a week later, I was in my room and my sister walked in and she saw the cuts on my arm and I became on watch to my family. I couldn't be home alone. I couldn't be in my room alone. The only time I was allowed in there really was to sleep. All the pills were taken, all the scissors were hidden. I really lost anything sharp, anything that could have really been dangerous, and I didn't understand it at the time. I thought they were being dramatic because they just didn't understand. And I had another doctor's appointment. I was very prone to them. I would go often because, you know, I thought you'd go in, do the same thing, have the same conversation, answer the same questions. You're normally out within 10 minutes. This appointment, I was not out within 10 minutes. My doctor, she sat me down and talked to me, and she pretty much just said, Mia, if I don't see you better within 2 weeks, you're going to a psychiatric hospital because me and your family don't think you'll make it past much longer if you don't get better. So I had another appointment 2 weeks later. I went back in. I faked it all. I had a fake smile, the fake laugh, and I got really good at faking it. So she believed me, and she sent me home. Told my parents I was better, you know. She saw a big difference. But the truth was, I knew how to hide behind a smile. And I started hurting myself again soon after that. And then one day, it was a very hard day. And I went searching for the pills. And I found them. And so I thought, you know, since I found them, there's only one thing I know what to do. And they were all sitting in front of me, but I still couldn't. It just like felt like a pit in my stomach. And something was just saying not tonight. And at the time I always thought, you know, maybe that's just saying it's not gonna work tonight. So I need to do it another night when I know it will work. And later on that week, I was in the garage with my dad and, you know, having conversation with dad. They just talk bunch. And I didn't respond because I didn't have conversations at this time. And I remember very vividly to this day, he was sitting in his chair and he looked at me and he had tears in his eyes. And I didn't know what he was gonna say. And he looked at me and he said, "Mia, you're my daughter. Dads are supposed to fix things. And this is something that I can't fix for you. And I don't know what to do." And I sat there as my dad, that's 50 years old, is crying because he's scared that he's gonna lose his little girl. And in that moment, I knew that I had to get better because I wasn't the only one hurting. I always thought I was just the one suffering, but I wasn't. I had to heal. I had to heal for them. I had to live for them. My mom, I mean, the whole time she'd hold me while I cried until I couldn't breathe. My dad would read me scripture and stuff from the Bible a lot, but I didn't think there was a God. So I didn't believe. I didn't believe anything he said. My sisters, they'd cry to my mom because, you know, they saw me at my worst and they didn't know what to do. They didn't want to lose their sister. So at that point, I decided I would go to therapy every week. At the time, I was already going, but I took it serious. I explained what was happening. I allowed myself to be vulnerable. I went to church any chance I could. I didn't miss an opportunity to go on a Sunday. I prayed and I truly spoke to him. I didn't just brush it off like, "You're not talking back to me, so you're not real." And I cut off a lot of people who fed me the lies about, you know, God not listening and the people that just weren't good for me. And I allowed myself to ask for help. I allowed myself to be vulnerable and realize that not being okay is okay. Later on, a few years later, after I was better and, you know, I was happier, something was still missing. I always had that feeling, that question, like, why me? What was the point of this? If you truly want the best for your kids, God, then why are you putting me through this? Why didn't you heal me when I needed you to heal me, when I was ready to let go? And there was one night I couldn't fall asleep. I was awake until like 3 a.m, tossing and turning. And all I was thinking is, I feel like someone needs to hear my story. So I decided at 3 a.m, got up. I posted this huge testimony and story on Facebook. And I went back to bed after that. And I woke up with so many messages and so many shares from people just saying that they finally felt heard, that they're praying for me, that they're glad that they have someone that they can talk to. So I got so many messages, like private messages of people asking me questions for loved ones that they didn't know what to do. And it made my heart feel content in a way that it never had felt before. And then I realized that God chose me to go through this so that I could help others. He chose me to be able to tell my story so other people could tell their stories. And I realized that the voice in my head telling me, "Don't kill yourself tonight. Tonight's not the night." It wasn't fear or it wasn't worry that it wasn't going to work, but it was God. God saying he's not done with me. And to this day, I have never been closer to him. He saved me 100%. And I don't truly think I would be where I was if I didn't have him that I could lean on. And I realized that everyone always said, you know, time will heal. Just keep going, time will heal this. But time doesn't heal, time won't heal. But God will.
at a point of great fear and darkness and terror, Peter wrote these words to the Christians in Rome. He said, "Always be prepared to give the reason for the hope that you have." And it strikes me as kind of funny that he never says what the reason is. He says, "Be prepared to give the reason." Well, then what is it? Tell us. And it's because everybody's story is different. You know, the Bible makes it clear there's one way to God. Unapologetically, that way is Jesus. But all of us arrived here in different ways. All of our pasts look different from one another. My story doesn't look like Mia's. My story might not look like yours. And you may be intimidated by the idea of offering your testimony because you feel like your life was uneventful. You know, you grew up in church, you were baptized as a teenager, your dad's a preacher, me too. You might be sitting there thinking, "This doesn't apply to me. I've never once considered hurting myself. I've never been tempted to pull away from my faith or anything, but this absolutely applies to you." Because you might share your boring story only to discover that the person you're talking to has the same boring story as you, and they've been searching for a reason why. That's not how this works. We don't get to choose our story. You might be sitting there thinking, "I can't share my story because mine was too eventful. I don't want to glorify the things I did in my past. Or I'm afraid that the drama of what I did is going to distract from the story of Jesus." But that's not how this works. It's not up to us to self-censor the stories God wrote. It's up to us to find our why and to share that why with other people. So the fact is, the overwhelming majority of people who will hear this message are thinking the same thing many of you are right now. "I'm just not special. My story isn't special." You're not alone in feeling that way. But your story could potentially save someone's life, change someone's eternity, and that someone might one day be you. Peter says this. He says, "Always be prepared to give the reason for the hope that you have." But then he cautions us, "Do this with gentleness and respect, keeping a clear conscience, so that those who speak maliciously against your good behavior in Christ might be ashamed of their slander." At the lowest point for these Christians, at the time of their greatest need, Peter says this, and he's clearly alluding to the Romans. Peter doesn't say hide. Peter says tell your story, because when you combine your what with your why, what is produced might be compelling enough to change the heart of even a Roman. It might even be powerful enough to turn the heart of Nero himself. So don't hide your story, because if their story could move the heart of mass murderers, people like Nero, it means there's hope for your neighbor, there's hope for your mom, there's hope for your husband, your kid, your sister. There's hope, but you have to do the what and you have to know why. You have to know why it matters. So why? How will you respond? What's your why? You have a story to tell, and you need to tell it. Here's mine. My mom and dad always wanted kids. They grew up with several siblings each, and they just knew they wanted to have children one day. But life doesn't always give you what you want. And although they tried, they were not able to conceive for quite a long time. They were told by doctors that it just wasn't possible for them to have kids. At one point, they did conceive, but they miscarried. And the doctor basically said, "Why are you putting yourself through this? It's not going to work." Eventually, they conceived again, and the conversation was the same. They braced for loss. But the days ticked by, and baby kept growing. And each time they would visit, the doctor's prognosis never really changed. He would just kind of change the timeline. The doctor said, "This baby isn't going to last another few weeks." Then he said, "The baby's not going to survive to the first trimester." He said, "There's a chance you'll make it to the third trimester, but the baby won't make it long past birth. You may make it to term, but he won't survive long." And he said, "Well, okay, maybe he'll survive. But he's going to be born with serious defects. His lungs aren't fully formed. His brain isn't yet fully formed. He's not going to have quality of life. Why are you putting yourself through this?" And then in 1990, a boy was born. It was me. They took me to the NICU. I was small. I was frail. But 35 years later, I'm still here. I'm still ticking. Medically speaking, the worst issues that I've got are ADHD and migraines and a little extra weight around the middle. Although I think that's probably due more to the breakfast cheesecake than it is to anything else. Listen, I don't think I'm anyone special. I want to get that out of the way. I don't have delusions of grandeur. I don't think I'm going to change the world. And I have been burdened my whole life with why. Why me? There are millions of babies who didn't get what I got. And I can't explain that. I don't know that why. But I do know, scientifically, I'm not supposed to be here. I do know medically, I'm not supposed to be here. And God said, I don't care. I'm doing it anyway. And if God did that for me, although I don't know why, this air is not my own. I have no choice but to use it for him because I don't belong to me. And that's my why. I have reasoned out my faith just like most people have. I can tell you historically why I believe that Jesus and David and Moses were real people that actually lived. I can tell you philosophically, doctrinally, why I believe that baptism is an important part of the salvation process. It's not just merely a good thing we should do. I can tell you why I believe that intelligent creation, rationally, just makes more sense than evolution. But all those whys that I have reasoned through, they are secondary. My why is the air in my lungs. And if I have it, I'm gonna use it for God. Today, I'm gonna use that air to pray. I'd like you to pray with me. I know that some of you know your why. You know what you believe, you know why you believe it. Some of you don't. And I hope that you will wrestle through that. But today I want you to pray that when you find it, you'll have the confidence and the courage to share it with others because it could change people's eternity. Would you pray with me for that confidence? God, it's so unnerving and unsettling to tell people, this is why I believe it, even if I don't have all the answers, even if I can't explain it, even if my story isn't something special. But God, I don't get to pick that. You picked it. You picked me and you picked every person in this room. It's our job to tell our story. I pray that you'd fill us with the confidence to do that. I pray that as we wrestle with our own stories, that we would be aware of the fact that things that may seem small to us could be answers that other people have been looking for a long time. So please fill us with that confidence. Give us that courage to share that with others. Because God, you shared your son with us. It's the least we can do. I pray this today in his name.